Good day, vagabonds, miscreants, and all manner of troublemakers. This is Paulo Espanola, and you are listening to Hidden Apron Radio, where we seek to showcase people in the world of food that have the most especially messy stories. People who decided not to follow the tried and true and instead roll around in the dirt that we call life. You'll hear from folks who have pulled off 180-degree turns doing things they never would have imagined. People who had a dream and made it work despite the usual challenges of family obligations, 9-to-5s, and not quite knowing where it's all going to lead. We've talked to professional athletes and their take on nutrition, corporate veterans who went from the boardroom to the family business, lifelong restaurateurs, young farmers and chefs, and if they have an interesting story that shows just how colorful and rich the world of food is, trust us, we're going to tell it. So, I have to admit that this episode feels a little bit different because for once, I am not recording it in my room, seated on the floor with my mic and laptop perched on top of a repurposed apple crate that acts as my table on some days, my chair on the others. I mean, such is the reality of a New York lifestyle, right? And today, I happen to be using my roommate's room, which is an actual table and chair, so this episode feels like extra, extra legit. But I mean, why bother, right? Like, why do I even bother bringing this up? Because it's a hustle. So what does my lack of furniture have anything to do with this episode? Well, I bring it up because a few friends congratulated me the other week of us hitting our 20th episode and how it must have been hard and there's no way to balance it with my day job and the learning curve must be steep. And to all the people who have congratulated us, thank you so much. I am flattered. But guys and gals, to be honest, it really didn't take a lot. I mean, I'm recording on top of an apple crate, and on some days I stay late in my day job office so I can use an empty conference room, and my mics don't even have a proper case, so I keep them in an old shoebox for the food god's sake. I guess my point is that if you really, really want to do something, the actual logistics isn't often the hardest part. I truly, truly believe that it's the mindset. So if it feels right for you, and note that I don't say if it feels easy or comfy, but right, give it a go. If you have something to give, give it. Give it freely, and don't expect anything in return. Which brings me to this episode, which features someone who's doing what's right for him in the face of tough odds. Our guest is Jabir Albihani, who I met at one of his dinner events while searching for volunteering opportunities during Ramadan. Jabir started his journey as an engineer and during a trip to Barcelona took part in a commonplace but nevertheless transformational experience of breaking bread with total strangers without worrying about being judged. He's sought to recreate that experience since then through comida, based on the Spanish word for food but spelled differently, which is his form of activism where he gathers people of varying backgrounds to share stories and food at local restaurants. Now, the particular dinner where I met Jabir was a unique one because it was part of a dinner series called Displaced Kitchens, which featured newly settled refugees here in America who cooked recipes of their homeland while sharing the struggles that they face. With immigration being a very, very relevant and controversial topic today, these dinners have served to humanize the refugee and connect New Yorkers, and soon, as you'll hear in the episode, other Americans, to people they would normally only hear about on TV. This episode covers a lot of ground, and many of these topics are definitely hard to discuss without getting too political. So, F it. Why the hell not? We waded deep. Jabir shares his experiences of starting Comida and how food has helped heal our deeply divided society. Listen in particular to his story of the time a Black Lives Matter activist sat down to share a meal with a Trump supporter, and you just might be surprised of how it ended. We also talk about his approach to giving back and helping when things seem overwhelming. How do you channel your energy and create change if marching in the streets, as valid as it is, isn't your cup of tea? We cover his experiences balancing between a very conservative upbringing and a rapidly changing world and the importance of questioning your own beliefs. Most importantly, we talk about just being you. And you know what? That's all we can really strive to do. So listen up. We hope you enjoy this episode. Folks, Jabir Albihani.
Jabber, welcome to Hidden Apron Radio.
Thanks for having me, Paolo.
Like I was telling you, I'm excited because this is the first episode in our new batch, and I'm glad that we're finally... I already know we're not going to be skirting over the hard issues with this one. Like when I was doing research, there's no way we're going to go around politics. So to the listeners, you already know what you're listening into. So before we get into that, I wanted to do a quick origin question about the name.
Okay.
Comida. So I know on your website, you know, there's a story about you having a meal in Barcelona. So could you go a little bit into the meaning behind the name and how that came to be?
Okay. Yeah. So after I graduated college, I went on a Euro trip. Figured that's kind of like everybody's dream after they struggle for X amount of years. So one of my favorite cities on earth were Barcelona. We get there. I'm there solo. I was traveling alone the whole time. And I stayed at hostels everywhere I went. So the first few mornings, I would wake up early, go get breakfast because it was free.
Yeah.
I was traveling on a budget. So one night I go out, you know, went out a little late, partied a little too hard, woke up well past breakfast. And the guy who was running the hostel there, who was an Argentine who was managing the hostel, he didn't find me at breakfast. Yeah. So I guess he was concerned because he knew I went out the night before.
Yeah.
So he came up looking for me. I'm there laying in bed. And he comes and he shakes me.
Yeah.
Comida. Comida. Comida.
Yeah.
He didn't speak much English. So I was like, okay, all right, I got it. So I woke up, I got ready, went downstairs to the lobby. What I thought it was just going to be me and him, like to go get food. He was going to give me food. Wound up being like this collective of other travelers from the hostel.
Who also woke up late.
Yeah. So so we were all waiting there for lunch. And it was me and six other people. And then he comes out, Lewis. He drags us and he's like, all right, let's go. So we go for a walk. He gives us this little tour of, you know, Las Ramblas and, you know, the local area. And 20 minutes later, he walks us into this little mom and pop restaurant. We sit down. No menu. No nothing. An older couple greet us, right?
Yeah.
They introduce themselves. You know, they spoke English. And we were just, you know, engaging.
Yeah.
And we start talking. Me and seven strangers and then this hospitable couple. We sit down at the table. They bring out drinks. We're talking. We're engaging. And then food starts coming up. Tapas after tapas after tapas. Almost a dozen dishes that we've never had before. Food I never tasted. Food I was unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
With people I was unfamiliar with. And then this little shanty restaurant that I would have never walked into if I was solo. So by the time all that happened, I was just kind of in this element of euphoria.
Yeah.
Right? It's like this very humanistic experience. Me engaging with others without any guard, right? Without any barriers worrying about if they'll judge me or not. I'm never going to see these people again, right? But this experience that I had with these parents and this food and these people just kind of culminated into something so natural. And we left, and it was something that stuck with me. Ever since I left Barcelona, it's like that dinner was so vivid.
And when was that? When did this trip happen?
2000 and what was it? I graduated 2010.
Okay.
And then I stuck around. And then 2011. Early 2011.
Right.
So I left in January 2011. Made it into Barcelona in February 2011.
So did you start Comida immediately after that?
No. So graduated from my bachelor's. Graduated from my bachelor's. Took the summer off. And then I started my master's program because nobody was hiring then.
Mm-hmm.
I got offered a fellowship by my professor who I did research under, doing undergrad. And I was like, okay, there's nothing better to do now.
And what were you studying, by the way?
Civil engineering.
Right.
Yeah. So I went from doing my bachelor's in civil engineering. Then I did civil environmental. Got my master's in that. Did research on pervious pavements. Doesn't sound too fun, but it's pretty cool stuff. What it is kind of pavements that absorb kind of rainfall so that we don't have runoff.
I've seen those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They look like when you pour water on them, they suddenly like
infiltrates
dry
out. Right.
Through. Yeah. Okay.
And what I was working on was this new innovation using recycled plastic as the adhesive, as the bitumen of all the gravel and materials to kind of hold the slabs together.
Yeah.
In order to allow for infiltration of the water. So anyway, yeah. So I studied civil engineering my master's, then finished that up, and then got back and started working into the corporate world. You know, just kind of beginning my quote-unquote dream job in geotechnical engineering.
Yeah, that's actually what I, when I was doing my, my prerequisite LinkedIn stalking. Uh-huh. I was like, how, I even wrote it down, geotechnical and instrumentation engineer.
Yeah.
And in my head, I was like, okay, there's that, and then there's this food thing. So you went into the corporate world, and then...
Went into the corporate world, started working. I loved it. You know, it was fun stuff. But then I guess a year and a half in, 2 years in, I just wasn't feeling it anymore. It was becoming too mundane, you know, like just systemic every day, 9 to 5. I got to be up at 7, shower, make sure I catch the train.
Yeah.
And it was just clockwork. Yeah. And by the time I know it, like 2 years gone by and I'm like, I've been doing the same shit for 2 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like I wasn't really advancing where I wanted to be within the company. And then I was like, all right, my entrepreneurial itch came back. It's like, I need to do something. I need a little more excitement. So I started to recreate the experience I had in Barcelona here in New York.
And were you in contact with those people, by the way, throughout these years?
Only one of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of them. Wow. So it really was one of those like idyllic, like things that you only hear in stories where, wow. Okay.
So it's like, and it's better that way.
Yeah. No. Of course.
It's like sometimes, you cross paths with people like, it could last 10 years or it could last
There's 2 something hours. Romantic about that. You know? It's like you get this amazing experience and you never see him again.
And you will never have it again.
Sure. Right? Okay. So you try to recreate it.
So I tried to recreate this experience here. So I began like a lot of like just basic, very fundamental like testing. I started approaching restaurants, surveying them, surveying general consumers and getting a lot of feedback on things. And I was like, all right, let me just test out an event. So I did one at Glow Thai restaurant in Bay Ridge.
Okay.
I had a relationship with the owner there, and I told him, this is what we'll do. We'll set up a prefix menu, set price. You tell me how many people you want to host. What's the date and time? We created the experience, and then I began marketing it on Meetup and social media and email. And the first event, probably like 95% of the people were my friends.
So you were advertising for the restaurant, right? So it's not like the restaurant brought in a new, totally new, unknown chef. It was their menu.
Yeah, it was their menu.
Sure.
Right? So the menu was either fixed on their menu already. The items were already fixed on their menu. Or they probably wanted to experiment with something and get feedback from this collective.
I see.
Okay. So what we did was like we advertised it as a comida experience, right? And our initial slogan was meet, greet, and rate what you eat. Right? You meet people, you greet each other, and then pretty much you rate the food you eat. Sure. So we printed out rating cards and, you know, we sat everybody in a communal setting. The chef would come out, introduce each dish, you know, explain the food, you know, just kind of that typical dining experience with strangers. But my first event, 95% of them wound up being my friends. Great. I loved it. I love my friends
expected,
to death.
Yeah. As expected.
And then I started realizing, okay, I can't have my friends come to all of my experiences. Sure. Otherwise, there's no business here.
Right.
So started hosting events and I stopped inviting friends and I started noticing more strangers were coming.
And they were finding you through
Meetup and Meetup. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and just kind of guerrilla outreach.
Yeah.
I'm messaging everybody like a desperate person on Twitter. Yeah. Please come.
Yeah.
And then like 50 events later, like
50,
like this is all validation testing, right? And this is over a course of like a year and a half, 50 events later, it's like it just started moving, working on its own.
Right.
We would sell on average 70% of the seats offered at every experience. We understood the restaurants and the chefs who were working with us, what they were looking for, what they were struggling with, and then vice versa with the consumer. And then what we found was that general consumers want something more.
More than what?
Just a typical dining experience.
Like a meal, basically.
A typical appetizer entree, you know, slap down the food, eat it, enjoy.
And then you pay and leave. Okay.
Yeah, right? And we as a collective, as people, like so immersed in social media and seeing everything at our fingertips.
Yeah.
I started to realize that people wanted more. They want to experience what Instagram influencers experience. Right? Or like stuff like Anthony Bourdain's experience. Mm. And just a recent survey, we did like a follow-up survey with our users and we asked them, like, what are some of the things that you really like about the comida experience? Mm-hmm. And two things stood out. Mm-hmm. The access to the chef and then the opportunity to meet and engage with others. Well, what I found about the later one, the the fact that people want to meet other people, engage with others. Mm-hmm. I had to change my slogan because of that. Because people were reluctant, right? And they didn't want to kind of, they didn't want a proposition where I'm providing you a setting where you get to meet strangers and eat with them, right? And I found that as a barrier. So I changed the slogan mm-hmm. to Discover, Taste, Interact.
Right? Right, because now it feels less like a social, like a speed dating event. Yeah, right,
because there's uncertainty. But then we started to focus on this experience element, because people go to events, they don't care about who else goes, because they know it's going to be a good time. So I shifted Discover, Taste, Interact, focused on the food, because food is a natural social node, right? It'll bring people together. And then literally like 2 years later, I do a survey, and the second most valuable thing is meeting other people, is socializing. And I'm like, okay, so you're learning as you go building this out. And then the fact that people have access to these chefs makes them feel like they are more welcomed. Yeah. Right? And that's something that we as humans want, naturally. Right. Right? Whether we admit it or not, we are going to come and satiate our appetite and eat. But what can we get a little more? Right? To kind of take away from this experience.
Or in a way, it's also, what can we get back? Because if you think, prior to the advent of food culture today, mm-hmm. you always saw your chef. You know, you go to a friend's house, you see the mom. You know, you go to even big events, you know who's cooking the food. Exactly. So I don't know if it's adding more than it is regaining what we lost, maybe, you know?
Well, it's I think what it is it, these days it's easy for people to share their story, right? And whether we want to hear the story or share it ourselves, there are a lot of... What we see on social media is just a very small segment of what's actually out there, right? Over seven billion people in the world, right? How likely are you going to hear everybody's story? Not.
Yeah.
But what if you create like little microcultures, right? And I'm coming to a restaurant and I'm hearing the story of the chef who's running this restaurant.
Yeah.
And he tells us a story. And the food we're eating is kind of inspired by his mom's cooking or his dad's cooking or where he comes from. There's more substance to the food.
It actually tastes better.
And it does, right? Right. Right. Now there's this emotional attachment to what you're eating because you know the person who made it.
Right. And who are the likely candidates for restaurants to partner with? Did you notice like a pattern? Like, oh, these types of restaurants were more willing to partner with us.
It varies. The restaurant industry is a very... it's tough to work with, especially when you come in from like with no experience. Like I'm a civil engineer by trade. Like I was always hustling growing up, but I never worked with restaurants until Comida.
Yeah.
And, you know, every day I learn something new about them. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for me to kind of pinpoint with regards to which restaurants are willing or not. What I understand is, one commonality is that a lot of restaurants lack the resources or understanding to market themselves. And where I come in is I come in with a very genuine approach and I tell them, look, this will be a mutual relationship, mutually beneficial relationship. Let's curate an experience. Depend on us to market it for you. We'll drive in the customers. And then after the first experience, we'll sit down and we'll have a discussion. You tell me what you liked, what you didn't like, what worked, what didn't work. And what I found were the restaurants that actually I have relationships, personal and professional relationships with now, are the ones who kind of gave me the opportunity and understands the process. Delivering right away is no longer the style to go about business. You kind of have to nurture. You have to educate. And you have to educate each other.
You got
to
put the time in, yeah.
That's it, right? And so the restaurants who are willing to experiment are the ones who are willing to work, like, who work with us.
Ah, I see.
Some restaurants are just set on their ways.
Yeah.
And if I categorize the types of restaurants, you have old school restaurants.
Yeah.
Right? You have some in transition who just don't really know what's going on. And like where we should focus our priorities. And then you have the new school restaurants. And the old school restaurants just don't get it. Old school managed, right? Old school management. They just don't get it. They don't understand it. They just push us away. Because they're just pretty much, they're traumatized by all the sales approaches they're getting by technological companies trying to sell them this and that and that. I mean, they've been burnt enough. And I understand that. And then you have the new school restaurants. Right? People who are managed and understand, you know, modern marketing techniques and what are trends. They see us because, okay, they can leverage us.
Right.
Right? And vice versa. Right? Because it's mutual leveraging. And
they understand that it's a new dining culture.
Yeah. And you need to experiment. Because some restaurants don't know how to market. They'll go to Groupon or Yelp, or they'll go on Instagram and post, but they post without understanding that this post has to be nurtured over and over and over and over over time. You need to narrate a story over time to keep people hooked.
You can't just post once and then wait a month. So this is interesting, because if you had said, I used to work at Ogilvy, one of these big marketing firms, and now you're talking about marketing strategy, I get that. But what's interesting to me, and this is not a put down at all, because it's almost every other episode, this is exactly what happened. You were an engineer, right? And it sounds like to me, you had to pick the marketing up along the way. If you had to say, what are the skills that engineering has given you that really helped with Comida? And on the other hand, what are the skills that you just had to pick up? You know, I know there's probably a lot more in the second bucket, but if you had to pick like one or two, like, wow, I did not know that coming in, what would you say is in those two buckets?
I think what helped me as an engineer, like I studied a lot. And one thing I always wanted to work in was in foundations, right? The very beginning of building anything. And
by foundation, you mean like the physical
buildings, actually footings, the piles, the foundations, everything that will set your structure straight, right? And it won't collapse unless there's something catastrophic.
Sure.
Or you're a horrible engineer. So with that, I always, like, you always start at the beginning, the very forefront. And that's one thing that I always take with me all the time. Every problem or any situation that I want to address, I need to understand what is the foundational problem that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Right? What is the baseline we're working with? And then how do we get to the goals we need to get to? That's I mean, no pun intended, foundational for me, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that has kind of helped me. But because of that, it kind of allowed me to begin experimenting and testing and learning and researching. And everything that I've absorbed till today really comes from real life experience. Nothing is textbook, right? And I read a lot on the internet, but I'm a person that there's so much content on the net. You just drown in it. And to follow it continuously, you eventually just become like it. Like your mind just cycles and you won't absorb anything.
Right.
So with me, I identify problems and I'll go on the net and I'll type in that problem and I'll see what comes up. And then from there, I see some methods that work, I'll test it out. If it works, great. If it doesn't, scratch it. And then just kind of going over and over and over. It's all iteration. So what I picked up along the way was literally more than I've ever learned in college.
Surprise, right?
Yeah, right? And, you know, just, I don't know. I'm just like a big supporter of experience, but like true experience. Like you need to be committed to something to actually understand something. And for me, like Comida is like, this is a very promising project. And like, I wouldn't be working on it if I didn't see like a very bright future for it. And I do. And for me, that's the reason why I am, you know, I have initiative to learn, prove, and be more of a resource to restaurants. One, because they really don't have a resource they can depend on. Mm-hmm. Everybody just takes their money and gives a service, right? But what good is that as a restaurant owner, especially today?
Right.
You need to be a thought leader. Not many are for the restaurant. There's a very small few, and do they even subscribe? Do they even have time to subscribe to these people? No. So if I could be in your face, or we can beat a brand that provides you the resources that will better improve your business over time, why not?
Yeah.
And then the same thing with our customers, our members, right? Our community members. They want to experience food like an influencer, right? But that's very VIP stuff.
Yeah.
Like I only have 6,500 followers on Instagram, on Comida.
Yeah.
And we get approached as influencers, right? Come to our event, you know, do you, right? Yeah. And these are very VIP events. And I sit down with, you know, a group of awesome people. They're all influencers.
Yeah.
20, 30, 100,000 followers on Instagram. You feel like you're in the White House, you know, of the food world. And I just, like, I'm just looking at, like, what they're doing and how much fun they're having. Food's just coming out. And the chef is explaining each dish.
Yeah.
Very curated, right? Because the restaurant knows this is a lot of marketing power in this room right now, right? A collective of over a million people reach. If you easily sit 10 people in a room of Instagram influencers.
Yeah.
Not that I contribute as much as them, but I'm in that presence. And I'm seeing that. And I'm seeing what they enjoy. They're working, the influencers, but they're also enjoying the food too. So it's like, why can't I recreate this experience for the general masses? Right? Because people want this.
Although in the general masses' defense, this is maybe just me talking as someone who works in social media. Yeah. This is my day job, right? But reach as a as just a pure number isn't the whole story, right? Because if you have one guy who has a million reach, but the million could care less, right? They just like liking your colorful cupcake picture.
Yep.
The change that you impact, and I think this is why when we get into displaced dinners in a bit, this will come up again, but if you only have 6,500, but those 6,500 radically change their mindset because of what you posted, which one's better?
Right? Yeah, and it's all about your conversion rate, right? And the effective reach. Those people who will actually become a customer.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's the goal.
Right.
Right? Bring butts into seats. And then it's up to the restaurant to really assure that there's retention of that consumer. Right? So for them, they take a risk. Right? Influencers don't pay for food. Right? They don't pay for the meals or nothing. They just leave a tip. So for them, it's food cost. That's their marketing cost.
Yeah.
Let's put out this reach. See what happens. One company that really does it well is Black Tap.
What do they do?
It's a burger shop, but they make some of the most elaborate milkshakes. The burgers are delicious.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen those.
Like the crazy-ass milkshakes with like ice cream and bacon and sprinkles and chocolate-covered strawberries unicorns and all that. And they have one of the most Instagrammable food items out there. And you walk by there, there are lines out almost all the time. Just by leveraging social media. And that's happened with almost a lot of everything food. It's reshaped our culture, our perception of food.
For better or worse. Right? I mean, we could go.
Taiyaki, right? Yeah. Right? It's like, it's been around for how long?
It's ancient.
It's ancient. And it's like, oh, now it's glamour, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I must have it now. No, it's been literally next door or in the neighborhood over in Chinatown sitting there the entire time. Why haven't you gone and got it?
Yeah.
Just shows the impact of social media.
Exactly.
And that's what these restaurants bank on because they don't know better. Influencer? Yes, bring him in. All we have to give you is food? It's a low risk, potentially high reward for restaurants.
Right.
So, yeah.
So you know, where I kind of want to transition into is, and maybe this is me inserting my agenda, but again, how does that impact our society today, right? Because if we have something like a taiyaki and a person ends up not discovering, but now suddenly having a newfound appreciation for the Japanese culture or the Japanese diaspora in Chinatown, more power to taiyaki, right?
Yeah.
However, if you now have someone who, and I've seen this happen, where someone actually goes to the shop, buys a taiyaki, Instagrams it, scoops half the ice cream off, tosses it because they don't really want to eat it. Yeah. They just want to Instagram it. Then what's the point, right? So what I wanted to actually bring up was a story that you told us when you were in, I was at that dinner, right? Where you talked about a dinner where some mindsets were changed. Could you go into the story of when the Black Lives Matter activist sat down to dinner with the Trump supporter? Like, what was the context behind that and what happened?
Yeah, so this was one of our first displaced dinners. I think it was like either the third or the fourth one. And it was a little intimate table, 10 people. And there just so happened to be a Black Lives Matter activist and a Trump supporter.
And this was not planned. You did not like, I'm going to get...
these are people, it's a small table.
Yeah.
So you're bound to engage. Especially if you're strangers.
Oh, no, I meant like you didn't like look for this specific person to bring. Oh, no.
Well, these are people who voluntarily purchased tickets.
Oh, snap. Okay.
Yeah, so this was not even planned, not one bit.
Right.
So they voluntarily purchased tickets, which is music to my ears. Like, that's what, if I could get a Trump supporter to come to one of these dinners, the impact is already made.
Why did you think he came, by the way? I'm just curious.
Curiosity.
Curiosity.
I mean, it's
she.
Yes, it's curiosity. I believe that people want a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Not all, but there's a segment of people who continuously hear the same noise over and over and over and over, and they just want a new genre, just to see if there's something really out there. You're on social media. At some point, you do just kind of see the same news that kind of tailors your thoughts and perspective. Yeah. But then also you will also see other news every now and then of like opposing thoughts. And then you wonder, why do people think this way? Why do people feel so strongly about this thing? Mm-hmm. And I'm in the middle of that too. Like I come from a very, I guess liberal, you know, a liberal mindset. But I understand the other side. I try to understand. Mm-hmm. And I can't demonize them because it's only what you know, right? So somebody like him just hears the news all the time, right? Or he's on Twitter all the time. Everything's already curated around his perspective. Let me go into a neutral setting. Let me see what I could hear from this. They go. He goes, right? The Black Lives Matter activist. This is naturally his or her agenda, right?
Yeah.
They want to support this. Now they're at the table together. They're talking, right? Everybody introduces themselves. And eventually Lutfi comes out, the refugee, right? Sharing his story and talking. And then as they're continuing, they're talking. The smaller experiences kind of yield more questions, engagement, right? So they're asking questions. And I missed what he asked Lutfi, but I believe that he asked a question very kind of like, I guess, a bit antagonizing.
It was a loaded question.
I guess, but not as loaded as like, maybe it wasn't that loaded, but yes, like a little loaded question. And I guess the activist kind of took something to it. Like she was taken back. And then they started having a very civil conversation, right? Just kind of like sharing her perspective and giving analogies and kind of Lutfi sharing his story, his perspective on things as well. And then him kind of just watching him engage back. Mm-hmm. Right? Kind of sharing his perspective and why he thinks X, Y, Z. That is something that I believe he came for. Right? Mm. Let me engage with people who have the opposite mindset. It's also kind of an assumption that you're coming at a table with like-minded people.
Right.
At some capacity.
Right?
You're not going to meet a nut job liberal who's going to bash you over the head because you supported Trump.
Yeah.
Right? You're going to meet somebody who's, you know,
to some degree.
And they both found that. She found it as the activist for, you know, understanding why he supported him and vice versa. And, you know, he said that, like, my perspective has shifted, but it does not change my entire
viewpoint.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is fine. Minuscule changes make the biggest impact. If we were to have him leave and say, okay, fuck Trump.
Yeah.
Did you really make an impact?
Yeah.
Keep him thinking, right? Keep him open, right? Now he's opened up a little bit, right? And depending on that persona, do you want more? Or was that too much for you to handle? And is it even worth for you to shift your perspective on the topic at this point? And that's personal choice.
Yeah.
But we gave the people the platform to hear, engage, understand one another, all over food.
So I'm curious, though, because this could have ended very badly, right? You heard how many Thanksgiving dinners have you heard where like family themselves cannot go through one course without tearing each other's throats apart. Why do you think this one in particular ended the way it did?
It's funny about Thanksgiving dinners. Like I was listening to NPR all the time and they literally had a segment every day on how to deal with Thanksgiving dinners.
Especially this past one, it was nuts,
no,
right?
So 100%.
What made this one different?
Neutrality. Right? Family, you're going to argue with your family. It's natural. It's family, right? You're going to have some sort of heated debate if you're on different spectrums of the concept. So here, one, there's social good, right? No matter who you are, you want to help others. Mm-hmm. Whether you support Trump or Assad or, you know, Clinton, Bernie, doesn't matter. People want to help people unless you're a douchebag.
Yeah.
Right? That's just how it is. So for them, okay, here's this cuisine that I probably never tasted, right? So this might sway my perspective on that region, right? Some people are like that. Two, all right, let me hear this, right? Let me hear this authentic story.
Yeah.
Right? I don't have access to this. There's no TV show about refugees. Or if they are, they're swayed to the liberal ideology, right? Yeah. Fake news, blah, blah, blah. So now there's this neutral element. This guy's cooking his meal. sharing his story. He's just trying to make a few bucks so he can get by in New York. So everybody in New York already knows the struggle of living in New York. So now, okay, so now I'm going to try this food. I'm going to contribute financially to this refugee to help alleviate his struggle and her struggle. Mm-hmm. So now we have Yusra, our other refugee host. And I'm engaging with other people, right? So it's kind of enlightening in a way.
Yeah.
Fulfilling at some sense. We want to make a difference, but we as New Yorkers, we don't know how. Because we are so consumed with our time, our work, mm-hmm. right? We're just focused on ourselves.
Or the problem seems so overwhelming that yeah. what can one...
Okay, and it's like, I'm just as guilty of it.
Yeah.
And like, I found my activism through comida.
Yeah.
I found my form of activism through comida. Mm-hmm. I leveraged what I had. And I'm leveraging an opportunity to kind of share these perspectives. So with all that, like, people want to help. And especially in New York, you understand that struggle. So it's like, all right, if this person is going to get $300, you know, for an evening to cook dinner and share a story, that's a treasure chest for anybody.
Right.
Especially in New York. And that helps because our refugees come here, one in debt. Why? Because they have to pay for their flight to get here. The United States pays for that flight, but there's a bill, a monthly bill that you have to pay back.
Yeah.
Right? So what? You're already coming here in debt. If you do get public assistance, it's nowhere near the standard of living mm-hmm. for you to get by. Right? And then you know no English, you have no accreditation, you have no friends, you have no family, no resources.
Is there no support system?
There is. The outcomes are relative, right? It's... people get here, and I'm not a refugee. I'm just going by what I've been told. They get here, and I presume that they're already appreciative of what they have. They're appreciative of just arriving here. But I assume through that process, they've been promised X, Y, Z. And many of those promises go undelivered. And it's not because of... there's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of steps. And like a lot of people that you need approval from, and like monies. It's just way too complex to even address. But it's not to say that people aren't doing their part. There's a lot of charities popping open. There's a lot of organizations that are just focused on helping refugees resettle. Mm-hmm. And they're bare bones. They get no funding. Government isn't funding anything, mm-hmm. right? These organizations are so focused on helping refugees that they have no time to fundraise or like go market or do whatever. And it's just the supply is outweighing
the demand. Right.
And... you know, what people can get out of some of these organizations or like the resources or the promises, it's really relative to how hard they fight for it. But you only have to expect that these people are fucking exhausted.
Yeah.
They come from war zones. They're on a boat for 10 days, almost died, family killed, traumatized.
Yeah.
And they get here and they, you know, they found refuge. They're happy. Now they have to work even harder.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that is not clear. And I mean, I listen to the news quite a bit. I mean, you hear the stories of the people trying to cross the ocean and it becomes a statistic after a while, you know, it's yeah. hundreds of them drowning in the sea and you kind of get numb to it. But sitting at the dinner, listening to his experiences being in Bahrain yeah. and being persecuted, the 12-hour interviews, you know, having $70 here and paying $90 for yeah. the cab, that it makes it human, right?
It does. Because you could... watching the dinners, we posted over 30. Mm-hmm. Just like I've never seen a very attentive group over a dinner. Like sometimes our comida experiences, like away from the displaced kitchens, like the chef can't even speak because the people are having such a good time talking to each other.
Yeah.
Right? And they yeah. just like, all right, like thanks. Like, you know, it goes by the ambiance. But with these dinners, like the moment the refugee opens his mouth or her mouth, everybody just is... yeah. in attention mode. Everybody's just focused,
yeah.
listening. They want to hear this. They came for the food, but I say 90% came for the perspective, the story. And with these statistics, it's like, yeah, we do become numb to it, right? And you see these photos, even like with photos and videos, we're still numb to it, mm-hmm. right? We respond, we just don't know what to do. We don't know where to go, right? And then what do people do when they're angry? They go protest into the streets. Mm. Natural human, it's human nature. We don't know what else to do. What other resources do we have to help others in a collective manner? Every time, you know, a black person gets shot by cops and killed, Black Lives Matter. People are out in the streets. Mm-hmm. Vice versa, right? I mean, when Obama was elected president, People in the Midwest and South were mad, and they were protesting in the street. It's just nature. We don't know what to do because we are no longer dependent on our... We can't depend on our authorities anymore.
Yeah, it's like a collective rage that has no outlet.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's like we are... The only option we have now is either be super aggressive or become desensitized. And there's a very... And there's a... Within that spectrum, there's a gap of I don't know what the fuck to do, but there's something I can do. Right? And thankfully, we live in this age where we're so connected. Right? Like, how do we meet?
I found you online.
Online, right? And it's like, here we are talking to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
And you came to this dinner, you know, and it's like, and you heard something and, you know, you took that with you and you wanted to amplify it a little more.
Yeah.
So with these people just kind of being drained out as numbers and people here not knowing what to do, we had to find some sort of medium because we saw people protesting once the immigration bill was passed, the ban.
This is the travel ban. But so for the listeners who don't know the context, and it's not finalized yet, but there was a travel ban on six, right? Was it six?
No, initially seven.
Right. Majority Muslim countries, and no one could get here, which obviously affected a lot of people, even people who were supposed to legally come. So, you know, I think that's actually a good thing to bring up for context is... That feeling that you're describing, was that what you were feeling when the travel ban was announced? And is that why Displaced Dinners came to be?
So, yes. Right? And, but it's always been an issue. Like, my family's from Yemen. I'm Muslim. Right? I identify as Muslim. And kind of like this association of me being Muslim kind of began to put a weight on me as an individual on everything I do. And it's natural, right? It just happens. So for me, what really hurt me was just like last May. I went to Yemen due to a family emergency, you know, pretty serious. I couldn't get to Yemen because I needed to get there immediately. It took me 4 days to get in to Yemen. And then when I got to Yemen, I had to get there, pick up family, and leave. It was just like a medical emergency.
Yeah.
We couldn't leave for 5 days.
Because of?
And this was an urgent medical matter. And we had to stay in Yemen. Thankfully, my sister is a nurse, so she did the bare minimums.
Yeah.
But had these issues weren't, like, the war over there and all that weren't an issue, the outcome of that situation would have been a lot better.
Right.
But that's not what impacted me a lot, because these things happen. It's like the circumstances that those people are in, people in Yemen. Like, I was there for 5 days. Last time I was there was in 2000, 16 years ago. And totally different image. Like, you'd think that things would get better. It regressed exponentially. And I'm seeing 3- and 4-year-old kids literally working on the streets, selling items. Or kids picking through the garbage for food. Grown men just sitting out there without purpose. Women at home, because essentially they're afraid. And one, you know, it's a society where, you know, it's the men. It's a very tribal, old school mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
So the entire population is flattened.
Yeah.
Just in terms of psyche and nothing. There's no education from the get-go. The infrastructure sucks. Government is unstable.
Right.
And then I hear about this ban, and I think about those people. And I'm like, these people have been screwed over for years over a war that's out of their control. I wouldn't even call it a war. It's just literally like a dumping ground of bombs. And I was like, okay, Yemen is bad. Syria is bad. Entire Middle East is on fire. And now you're going to eliminate the one refuge, the one opportunity that they can escape it to better their life. And that's where it's like, shit. Like, these people are stuck in a circumstance that we, as a Western civilization, as a Western authority, gone into the Middle East and caused havoc. I don't want to get political, but we have destabilized the Middle East. There's no...
Or even if you don't agree with that, there is... I think it is safe to say that we bear some culpability.
Yes.
To some degree.
There, whatever that degree is, it's up to you. But
exactly.
We have an impact there.
Right.
And the fact that we can't even have the courtesy to let these people funnel out to find refuge and just have an opportunity for a better future, that just shook me. And, You know, Nasser is a good friend of mine from college when I went to Baruch for a year and a half. And we reconnected.
And, then, and he was already running the restaurant.
He was running the restaurant. And that's how we reconnected, because I had Comida and he had the restaurant. We started working together. And then the band came about. And I was just like, I don't want to go out and protest because it's pointless. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody else is doing it. I'm inspired. But I don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. And he was like in the same boat. Right? He was running the restaurant. I'm running Comida. We're just like going hard. And then that's where like the magic moment came. It's like, let's just host this place dinners.
Yeah. I think it was a quote from Nasser actually, when he said, the mistake that often the left side will say is, if you're not out there protesting every day, you're not in it. And it's like, well, there are other avenues, right? What are the other neglected avenues that you haven't pursued?
You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio, produced by myself, Paulo Espanola, and Ricky Ho. Just two ordinary guys trying to break bread and break boundaries. Thoughts, musings, ever just wanted to rant at us? Do let us know at hiddenapron@gmail.com or at hidden_apron on both Twitter and Instagram. Back to the show.
So what was the next step? So you thought, okay, let's do this thing. How did you go about identifying the first chef? So I know Lutfi was the first inaugural one, right? How did you go find him? Like, what was that process like?
So, you know, initially it sounded easy when you first think about it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's easy to do. Like, we can make this happen. And relatively, like, it was a bit of a challenge. Because the biggest thing you have to consider is what the refugee went through. Mm. Right? And even if they're willing, are they comfortable kind of being as genuine and not like kind of blacklisting like certain events within their life?
Right, because that was actually the second question, if you could answer that along with this, is how do you, after you found them, how do you coach them into telling that? Or not coach, but empower them to tell that story, right?
And it's, but the issue with them was like confidence, right? Or the trauma that they went through, the PTSD. And so you have a very small pool of people who are even able to do it. Mm-hmm. And then are they willing? Mm. Right? So then that pool is like gets smaller and smaller. Thankfully, we found Lutfi through the IRC or the IOM, International Rescue Committee, or the International Organization of Migration. Mm-hmm. So we found Lutfi through there. Arrived in December. We met him in March. Very charismatic. As if he
didn't as if go nothing through, happened. As if he didn't go through the shit that he says he did, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, and I'm like, okay, this guy is, I like him already. I know nothing about him.
Yeah.
He's twice a Syrian refugee, right? So it's not like he went through the process once. He went through the process twice.
Yeah.
Involuntarily. So it's like, I guess he is like just a beast, like, you know, like he nothing. Throw a lion at him and see what happens. He'll beat it probably. He's just a beast like that. So we found Lutfi, and you know, he was just very adamant about his way, what he wanted to do. He just give you a little backstory on Lutfi. He is a he identifies as gay. Right? So in the Middle East, like your family, if you come from a very conservative family, you're outcasted. That's it, by default. And any conservative family anywhere in the world, if you identify with some sort of LGBTQ affiliation, there's going to be some sort of repercussion.
Right.
From the conservative end. So he was taken away, like he was put out from his family, taken out of school at 19. And he pretty much escaped because he just didn't feel, you know, he didn't feel safe. So he sought refuge in the Gulf countries. And even there, he started experiencing, you know, extortion and blackmail. And he was jailed, you know, just simply for being homosexual or attending parties that had drag queens. And he went through a lot, country to country, and then deported back to Syria. When he got back to Syria, civil war started happening, becoming unsafe. He left, went to Egypt, and then from there, he was able to find refuge here. So with Lutfi, he had a very elaborate story. A lot to share, but with charisma. That's something, it just comes natural. Very hospitable. He knows how to treat guests. He does not let any of us kind of run the itinerary. You know?
Really?
He's like, no, I'm not going to speak until they finish this food. Oh. Or he's like, stop talking, guys. We have to bring the entree. And I'm like, as an event, like, you know, coordinator, producer, I'm like, oh, dude, you're killing my flow. But you know what? This is for you, you know?
Yeah.
You run it.
It's like you got that diva status going a little
pretty
bit.
Pretty much. Yeah. He wants to treat you as if you're home.
Yes.
You know? And you rarely get that. And it's like, I then realized, yeah, what's the point? Why take that away from the people who want to seek this?
Sure.
But yeah, so it's like just finding like people like that. Mm-hmm. He's very rare to find, just considering the circumstance and the probability that we were able to partner with him. So, but it's still hard to find additional refugees to share a different story.
Right, no, there's the one from coming up that's from Venezuela, right?
Or? Well, we're still kind of trying to get her
okay
out of her zone.
Right.
Still, like, worried. Because that's the MS-13 gangs. Like, she escaped persecution by that. And MS-13 is in New York, right? So she doesn't want to risk anything. So it takes a lot of, like, convincing and talking. But we're not going to push anything on anybody. Mm-hmm. If you see the value that you want to share your story so you could change the narrative, you want to make a little extra money, you want to feel welcomed by your new community, come to us as a refugee, right? And our goal is to empower. But it's struggle. It's a struggle for us to help empower others because they already have a barrier. Mm-hmm. And they really don't want to work with anybody.
Now, do you collaborate with other... Because I just had the thought, like, when it comes to trauma and PTSD, do you, for example, refer them to possibly get, you know, mental help or something like that?
That's so...
Or is it simply like, if you're ready, when you're ready to come... And share your story, we'll be here.
And that's what how we go about it. Like, they know we're there. Mm-hmm. And we reach out to nonprofit organizations and all that. They know about us. They know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. We've reached out to, and this is one thing that annoys me. We reach out to a few kind of refugee, culinary companies that work with refugees directly. Mm-hmm. Right? And we've had discussions and all that, but just nothing ever came to fruition. Right. I mean, this is a social impact movement, right? And we have a mission. It's humanistic. And the more we try to kind of get other people on board, the harder it becomes.
Why is that?
You
mean just simply logistics or?
It's just a matter of, I guess companies kind of look at things from a very different perspective, okay. Right? We've approached two companies that we thought would be a great fit, but we just never heard back. We had meetings and all that. Mm-hmm. No response. And then we realized the more we wait, the more time we are losing. And that's, you know, time potential because we want to make an impact for others. And what better time to do it is during a time that's being spoken about a lot. Mm-hmm. Come get a different perspective. So we said, you know what? Fuck it. We're not going to wait on anybody. We're just going to do it ourselves. And like we have three refugees that we worked with over the past 3 months. I wish it was 20 refugees, but the circumstance didn't allow because the resources that we thought would be kind of a valuable partnership didn't come about. Mm-hmm. So we don't want, so I guess back to your question, it's like we can't be an all-around resource. What we do is kind of create this bubble, right, where people can genuinely help. The nonprofits kind of do most of the hard work. Mm-hmm. Right, setting up with the medical or the housing and the relationships and all that. And then when people attend these displaced kitchens, the refugee already has this relationship now with this group of 8-10 people at every dinner. And they're talking. And it's very personal. Right? He'll come put his hand on your shoulder. You know, we'll talk. They'll ask open questions. If he wants to answer, he'll answer. But then at the end, people already empathize. And now what do they want to do? You want to help. You've already helped by buying a ticket to this event.
Yeah.
But now there's this emotional attachment, like you're hurt. Like, what more can I do? And literally, through our dinners, the refugees gotten job interviews,
right?
Gotten jobs, gotten shelter, learned about resources they would have never known, new friendships. You know, Lutfi, who's, you know, gay from Syria, he's never attended a
party
or anything like that. And sometimes, like, I'm just there, like, talking to Lutfi, and then I'm witnessing conversations with Lutfi and other people.
Yeah.
And, like, their gay guys would say, okay, I got to bring you to Fire Island with me. Yeah. Or, like, we got to go to the parade together.
Yeah.
And now Lotfi is finding his network.
And it's that, to me, was actually very surprising. And I don't know if it was intended or not. But in a way, they came to the dinner. There's food.
Yeah.
They probably support the person or the perspective. Or they want to hear about the perspective. But what ended up happening was everyone helped in their own way. Right? Because a while ago, we were talking about how they feel like you can't do anything. Let me go out in March. But now, whether it's unintentional or not, because they heard the story. I mean, I was sitting across from that family who was like, why don't you stay with us? Yeah. And then there was the other person who was like, I work at Tiffany's. Let me get you an interview. I mean, for me, I'm not even a citizen, but I have this podcast. You know what I mean? So I don't know if that's an unintended thing. Did you expect that people were going to offer their hand after the dinner?
I'll be honest, like, after this election and all that, I had a very not so promising outlook on humanity. Cynical. You know, not cynical, but it wasn't looking good.
Yeah.
But then the more I started, like, understanding the followers, or, like, my friends who voted for him, I started to see why. And I started to understand, like, it wasn't an attack on humanity, right? Mm-hmm. Some people prioritize things differently, right? So, like, for my Caucasian friends, like, they voted for Trump, right? Some of them, not all. But they voted for him for issues that related to them.
To them, right.
Right? Financial, a bright economy and all this. Fine, that's fair. Without really understanding the impact of how they are empowering an ideology mm-hmm. among the masses. I don't care about Trump.
Yeah.
He does him. Whatever, he's the president. The problem is the people who don't understand the impact of their votes. And it's not our fault because we've lost our obligation to do our civic duty.
Yeah.
Right? So we forgot about the impact of our vote.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like it's both ended, right? It's not just the politicians or the voters. Yeah. It's everybody. So, like, for them, they voted on something without realizing the implications. And the implications are obvious today, right? The increased rate in anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, the physical attacks, et cetera, et cetera. I can't blame, right? I became, the more I started working with people and kind of pick brains, I understood. So then as that started happening, we did the displaced dinners. And then literally, like right off the bat, people offered and offered and offered and offered and offered.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. It's like, I didn't expect this much of an impact.
Yeah.
But this was just well beyond what I expected.
Would you?
And it's beautiful.
So I don't know if this is, because I'm like almost sick of hearing this from the Filipino side, but did you actually get pushback though from the Arab community? Did you ever experience a moment? Because, and this is something that when I've interacted with some Filipino chefs, not all,
no.
You know, so a lot of them are being supported by the recent wave of like Filipino food is the next big thing. But I've also heard others were like, the biggest critics we have are our own people.
Yeah.
Did that happen with displaced dinners where specific segments of the Arab community or Arab American or even Muslim community where they're like, yo, that's not right?
I've come to a point where I just don't give a fuck. Mm-hmm. Social media just blatantly puts it in your face that everybody's going to have an opinion.
So there were instances where people were against it?
Nobody kind of objected.
Okay.
Right? Public or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I am 100% certain there are people within my community mm-hmm. who are probably saying, oh, why don't you feature a Muslim woman with a hijab who like probably has a yeah. more traumatizing story.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
blah,
yeah.
blah, blah. It's like, it's always, why can't you?
Yeah.
Right? But not why not? Like, why can?
Yeah.
So it's like, they're always going to find a reason to criticize you. It doesn't matter. Right? I'm going to get criticized from the left or the right. You want to hear a perfect example? My beard. Right? I have a beard. Over here, I'm suspect.
Yeah.
Right? The moment I landed in Yemen in May, my uncle picked me up from the airport. You know what he asked me?
Yeah.
What are you, Daesh?
Daesh
is ISIS.
ISIS, yeah.
And I'm like, the concept of a beard has been sabotaged from the Western world to the most tribal conservative place in the Middle East, geez. In Yemen. And it's like,
You can't win.
You can't win. Yeah. And it's like, you know what? Fuck it. Do you.
Yeah.
Do what you feel is right, as long as you know it's right and it's genuine. Mm-hmm. If they shit on you, they're going to shit on you anyway. Mm-hmm. It's going to come anyway, regardless. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's from traditional like Middle Eastern culture, society has a big impact on you, right? So you should take that into consideration. But if I did, I wouldn't be here now.
Yeah.
I grew up literally a homophobe.
Yeah.
Right? I grew up a homophobe. Just ignorant. Like, you know, you grow up in Brooklyn. You grow up in a very conservative family. These things kind of, you know, they kind of mold you into a certain way until you get out. And then I got out and I went to school in Philly, in Temple. I was in a different environment, but balanced, right? I had a very heavy African-American community, but then also the Caucasian student body who came from the local suburbs. So I met a lot of people. A lot of people found me interesting. I found a lot of people interesting. And that opened me up more. So from that to me working with a homosexual from Syria who had to escape because of sexual orientation.
Yeah.
And like every time I see him, I hug him, you know, and you know, we greet each other, the kiss on the cheek, and just hang out. And it's like, this just kind of helps me improve as an individual as well. And to try to get other people within my community to say, hold your beliefs. It's okay. Don't alienate anybody else though. Mm. Right? I have nothing against homosexuals or anything like that. Nothing. I don't, and as I don't, I have no animosity towards them like I did maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you get older, you start formulating your own conclusions. Then I start to realize that we are becoming marginalized as a Muslim group. Right? So how could we afford to hate on the other marginalized people while we want to be kind of left alone and be unmarginalized? Yeah. Right? You can't be Muslim and, you know, just hate the homosexuals or, you know, the Jews. And you can't be Jewish and hate the homosexuals and the Muslims. Like, it literally,
you're facing the same battle.
It's the same battle.
Yeah.
And we're all divvied up because of the way we dress and the things we believe in and the things we don't like. And this is a moment where we need to come together.
Yeah.
This micro segmentation of the human population, especially in New York, which is relatively obvious. Mm-hmm. It does us no good.
You know, I was I was telling you, I was at Bay Ridge yesterday, and we were at a restaurant, and I was two of my friends were Egyptian, and we were just talking about how everyone else might look at all the Arabi people, it's one big population, but within there, it's like, oh nah, he's Moroccan, nah man, F that, they're Sunni, like we don't talk to that. And it's like the story that I've brought up on almost a good 25% of the episodes in the podcast actually is the story of this research paper that I found in college. It's a very long research paper arguing who invented hummus, the Jews or the Arabs. And I was like, you guys are fighting over this when you could have sat at the table and enjoyed the hummus together. You know what I mean? So I think it's really your story. It almost seems like we live in an age where we're blessed to be able to be more connected, like you said a while ago. Yeah. But we're not doing it enough. You know, like put down the phone, get on the table, break bread. You know what I mean?
It's easy. It's you know, like from the outside, right? Like an Eid prayer.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I was worried. Like you have a big group, you know, a big group of Muslims are coming together. Well, today's world, you know what? Somebody could just drive their car right into the middle of Eid prayer.
Yeah.
This is literally a legitimate concern that I did not have 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I was like, no, I'm not going to hold back because of the what if. That's just not my mantra. So, and if this nut job is looking at everybody as one collection of people, why can't we, as a collective, look at each other?
The irony, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And it's like, he's the crazy guy.
Yeah.
But even within us, we're subdividing. Like you said, like, oh, he's Moroccan, he's Egyptian, and all that. Mm-hmm. I'm like, where's the, you know, it's just like, yeah, the irony and like, just people who can't realize this.
Yeah.
And I understand it's tough because the digital landscape has literally shifted the way we think, we look at things, and it's disrupting everything. Not just economies or progress, religions and culture and people and race. And it's really, this is the beginning of like this new future.
It is.
And this interconnectivity, yes, we're connected online, but we're more divided than ever in person.
It's a knee-jerk reaction because I was reading that, you know, in the last millennia, identities are pretty set. You come from this village, this is your identity. But now it's like, how do you define yourself? And if everything you know about Aden is being shaken up, you're going to want to grab a little harder. And so this might just be a backlash, and maybe we'll get to a future where no one sees all this. Maybe they're just like, they're human. Like, this is a dog. You know what I mean? I don't know. I did see a paragraph, though, and I wanted to get your take on this because this one surprised me. And going off of like the potential negative effects of dinners that Comida would put together or displaced dinners. One of the articles I was reading from Good was a paragraph was written from a food anthropologist who said there could be a risk of these events because if they are too curated for the Western palate or too touristy, this is just my take on what I think she's trying to say. There is a potential where the diner is disconnected from that culture that it's meant to be there. You know what I mean? Where it's like the Hasan Minhaj skit on Netflix where he's like, you get these Republicans who say, you know, ban the Muslims, don't let them come in. And then at lunchtime, they're like, yo, let's go to the halal cart.
Yeah.
Or Trump eating tacos. You know, have you thought about that? Is there a risk where these things could just be like, yo, let's go watch that refugee cook dinner for us? You know what I mean?
Back to what I said earlier about like all the content on the internet. Mm-hmm. It's like just like infinite, mm-hmm. right? Because there's so many minuscule ideas and thoughts of what could potentially happen, mm. right? It's not that, I don't know how to put it. It's the fact that we have to worry about kind of shifting the future, mm-hmm. right? We're already doing that. Mm-hmm. We're doing that without even realizing it, just through our natural action, mm. right? These displaced dinners, right? It will make a small impact, very minuscule, infinitesimal impact to people in the world. And you know what? That impact could shift, you know, some paths of people's futures. So for me to worry about like how like, oh, we might, you know, curate this story or this concept or this perspective to a Western palate, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a perspective from the most authentic source that you have your hands on, mm-hmm. right? Or would you rather just stay at home, watch TV, and continue hearing the same BS?
Right.
Right? If I'm going to worry about what the future looks in 50 years from now, to be honest, I have no control over what the future looks like in 50 years. I could only do what I want and what I feel is good, and I share my impact with the world. Right? I have no say on what the future looks like. Neither did King Solomon, neither did, you know, fucking King Henry VII, nobody. Mm. They shaped it, but the world continues to shape itself.
You're right.
So the more, you can't worry about little bullshit thoughts that, you know, create substance on the internet and everybody thinks about it. What if this, what if that? Stop thinking what if and fucking do it.
Yeah.
And if it works, it works. If it makes a positive impact, great. If it doesn't, it's not. Yeah, it's like, it's just going to happen anyway.
Right.
So for us to hold back and worry about this, that, it's... Because
it could be something that would have happened even if you didn't do the dinners, right? It's like...
It doesn't matter.
You know what I mean?
If I did it or somebody else did it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
This is my form of activism. Mm. I know it's right. Mm. And this is the best way for me to provide this to you, mm-hmm. to accommodate your lifestyle and your society, your culture, mm. as a Westerner. Mm. Right? So... Yeah, like I really don't take, like, considering like we were saying earlier, like just worrying about like backlash and what if this, what if that. It's happening. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
And we're here worried about the very low potential scenarios.
Yeah.
And putting energy to it, which is pointless.
Yeah. The analogy I would use is there was, and obviously this is less... It's less heavy, but something happened with the Filipino community where there was this backlash of like, yo, our food's getting too, it's bending over to the Western palate too much. We're losing it. And, you know, everyone was starting to get all worried about it. And then, you know, Filipinos started attacking each other. Like, you're selling out, blah, blah, blah. And the question became, you know, exactly what you said. Like, if we worry about that, what would you rather have? That we have this, and sure, we have these missteps, and we do our own thing. Or would you rather no one ever heard about Filipino food at all?
Yeah.
And maybe, I don't know why is it like that? Is it an inherent
Our tribal human instinct.
Mm.
If you really think about like a very I guess, peaceful, informed human society, right? Today, we still see very, very tribal communities in the world. The internet just shows you that. We in New York just happen to be a utopia, right? Or the big cities like London and Tokyo and you know, all these very advanced cities that live under rule. Very
cosmopolitan.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's also the societal rule of law.
Yeah.
Right? We're all human. We are better than animals, right? We are educated. We should know better. We should act a certain way. We have to understand that this is new to our history.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is like literally much like a crash course for dummies.
Yeah.
For the human race.
Yeah.
Right? Because you still have people living out in the Amazon, right? You still have people out in China, all these different towns, Yemen, places in Africa, you have London, you have Iceland. So the spectrum is wide, from the most primitive to the most advanced. Mm-hmm. We all still exist on the same place.
Mm, yeah.
Right? So the fact that, oh, it's a modern day version of imperialism, right? Through consumerism. Because how do you win wars? You have to destabilize from within. You have to destabilize your enemy. Mm-hmm. Just general concept, right? So how do you destabilize?
Create division.
Create division, just like we're experiencing today.
Yeah.
Right? And then the more divided you are, the more unstable you are. And now it's easy to come in and swoop. And it happens the same way. You have people who still have very tribal mindsets, which I have traits of because my family is Yemeni, right? And then you have people who are progressive, right? Kind of like the liberal and the conservative.
Yeah.
Over there, it's like tribal or progressive.
Yeah.
Like, still hold on. Like, there's always this division from within. And then any hint of external influence will be fought. And then that creates a division. So
it's instinct.
It's human. And we try to say, why are we like this? That's the only reason. There is no other logical reason to say that this is still in our DNA.
Yeah.
This is still how we think. Mm-hmm. Our behaviors, if the older you get, and I'm hitting 30, I have traits of my father and my mother. Mm. Little activities and mannerisms. It's not like it's voluntary. Maybe I learned it as I grew up, or maybe it's just in my genetic makeup. But it's in there. It's innate.
Yeah.
And we're still at the very early stage of this.
Of us as a civil of us as a species in this phase, you could say.
Yeah, right. This very peaceful or advanced.
There's like a very technical philosophical term of I don't know what it is, but it explains the concept that we've lost sight of the scope of just how much of a tiny speck this current, you know what I mean, is.
Day and age, yeah.
Yeah, and how we are continuing to evolve, you know, and to the extent that, going back to these dinners, that you can expose someone so that they evolve.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why not, right? Like, it's the 80-20, like, you're doing your part to push us a little bit along, you know what I mean?
A little bit. And yeah, and that's, we are going to evolve.
Yeah.
Whether it's for the better or worse. Mm. I mean,
where would you say, going to this thread of evolution, where would you say you're headed next? With that, not just with the space dinners, but with comida, with you, with...
As a human?
Where are you taking all of this?
My goal is to literally redevelop, like, nations that have been impacted by war. Mm. And through full, like, self-sustaining means. Mm. Like, that's my long-term goal.
Yeah.
I've always had this thing for real estate.
Yeah.
I mean, a civil engineer, like, I mean, not there yet, but I could easily study and, like, start working on this stuff.
Yeah.
And for me, like, I associate myself as a humanist, right? Like, I identify, I have labels. But my big goal is to literally go into places that have been impacted by war, give back hope, building schools, you know, building housing, all independent of an authority, whether it's good or not. That's my long-term goal. Mm-hmm. So for me, I want to build a culture with comida, right? To bring people together.
Yeah.
Right? Bring people together, support local businesses, give, you know, the people who make your food a platform to shine. Create a movement. The moment you're able to create a movement, then you begin to shift how people think and how people experience things. And like you said earlier, like, oh, we're starting to turn, we're starting to shift our cuisine to the Western palate. It's going to happen anyway. But then you know what's also going to happen?
Yeah.
There's going to be a time where people are going to say, I want to try really authentic Filipino food.
Yeah.
Where can I find
that? It's the gateway.
Right?
Yeah.
And then we could give you both spectrums.
I actually got that feedback because I got approached to someone, I guess, found my blog and they said, do you want to write for this publication?
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it and I guess I was just so hard on myself because when it came out, I was like, oh my gosh, I look like a sellout. And the feedback I got from my own community, which was very validating, was they were like, okay, maybe that's your thought, but we'd rather have us control the narrative because it's going to happen anyway, right?
See, and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Right? If now you're able to reach these people who felt the same way as you.
Yeah.
Not to say that you have an approach that's correct, but there's an approach. And now you have feedback and comments from people within your community.
Right.
Who also have an approach that they want to control more. Which is fair.
Yeah.
You have to hold your culture. Right?
Yeah.
So it's fair for the people who are, you know, like authentic to it and understand it and who are of it to control that narrative.
Right.
Rather than an external influence. Right? Because history is written by who? Whoever's in power. So it doesn't matter who you are. History is written by whoever's in power and that's how the narrative will be shared throughout history. Mm-hmm. And then what happens? People become forgotten. Histories become forgotten. So people who have a very strong affinity to their culture and religion and language, they're going to feel that way. And it's only fair to let them control that narrative if they're open to the progress of it. So, yeah, so and that's what it is. And it's so, like, back to comida, if I'm able to build this movement and get people to really experience things differently, you know, that's my gateway to connect with more people, but then also kind of pursue my dreams. Giving back to people, like at a larger scale, more humanistic scale. This Place Kitchens, this is only the beginning. Like, it's my first form of activism. Thankfully, like, it's been gaining a lot of good steam.
Did you ever think that you were going to be an activist?
I wouldn't consider myself an activist.
See, a lot of the people when I ask this question, or some form of it, like, the last one I asked, do you see yourself as an entrepreneur? And you're like, dude, I don't know. I woke up one day and I guess I'm an entrepreneur.
Yeah,
you know
it's... Right?
Like, did you... So you didn't think, like, I'm going to be this...
I knew at some point, it's funny, like kind of being a millennial at this age, right? It's very conflicting.
Yeah.
Right? So like, you know, and, but it's sometimes like the technology could kind of either steer you away from who you really are or it could bring you closer.
Mm.
For me, it brought me closer because I was able to see the world in a more realistic light. Mm. I grew up here. This is one of the best places on earth.
Mm.
Right? And it's not because I'm home. Like, I've traveled to other places. I've seen beautiful things. But this is a utopia. This is a privilege to live here in the States, especially in New York.
Yeah.
It's a privilege.
Yeah.
And many people take it for granted.
Yeah.
So it's like, let me try to maximize on this privilege. Right? To get back. So back to your question. It's like, I don't want to be labeled anything. Right? This is stuff that I need an outlet for. Because literally my soul burns. Right? For me to take advantage of this privilege that I have living in New York and trying to create something big and grand, I have to really give back to those who are less fortunate somehow. Just so I could justify this privilege.
It's like you're just manifesting you.
Yeah. So it's like, yes, I have something good here in New York and I'm going to take advantage of it, but I can't be fully selfish. Because you know what? I'm going to look back in 20 years and I'm going to say, fuck. I didn't do shit while all this was happening. But at least I know I did my part. Like something I want to do through my outlet, my way, right? With the people working with me. What better way? So that's why, like, I don't call myself an activist. I don't call myself an entrepreneur. I'm literally, like you said, like I'm manifesting. Everything I'm envisioning, I'm putting out there and I'm seeing what I can get back.
Yeah, I think one of the really powerful quotes that I saw in one of the articles when I was looking guys up was, you extract a little bit of good, you know what I mean? You extract a little bit, and it's a little bit, sure, but you do that across, if everyone puts a little bit, oof, it's
ridiculous.
It's change, right? I think that's a good positive note to wrap up on, because Yeah, you know, when topics like this come up, you're always afraid that, like, this could really go wrong. You know what I mean? Like, it's a hard topic. It's a hard topic, you know?
If you ask my friends, they think I'm a nut job sometimes.
Hey, everyone's a nut job. Like, anyway. Yeah. If someone says they're not a nut job, they're lying to you.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But it's like, you know, because, like, I do take this stuff seriously. Like, I take politics seriously because it has an impact on people.
Right.
An involuntarily negative impact on people, and it annoys me. But I've learned over time, especially like during these times, like you really have to channel the very positive outlooks to deliver a message that will reach more.
Is there something that you wish I asked you?
It's natural discussion. You can't ask for more. You know,
that's all we can hope for, man. That's all we can hope for.
If it comes, it comes. Yeah, exactly. Right? And like, I'm not here to get any like you know, brand promotion or anything like that. Like, we're just talking story, right?
That's the
I'm
whole
sharing
point.
A story. You know, you're picking my brain. If people take away what they take away,
yeah,
then I'm happy, whether it's for good or bad. As long as they know about what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's all I could hope for, right? It's like Comida, this is simply a platform for someone to tell their story however it comes out.
Yeah.
So I'm going to close out with a section that we close out every episode. It's a series of questions that are very short.
Okay.
You can answer them as short as long as you want, but the questions will be very short.
Okay.
Okay. Person who most influenced you with what you're doing today?
Pharrell.
Pharrell? Whoa, okay. I gotta follow up. Because that was okay. So for some context, when I ask this question, I usually tailor it to what the person's doing. So if the person's a writer, I'll say what most influenced you as a writer. But because you've done engineering and now you're doing activism and you did food and you want to do real estate, I didn't want to like limit it.
Yeah.
So I'm a little caught off guard. Why Pharrell?
So I grew up listening to his music.
Okay.
So I was always a fan of him there. But then the older I grew and the more I started reading these entrepreneurial magazines.
Yeah.
I saw him dabbling in a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Right? I saw his portfolio. It was very diverse and for very good things. Empowering kids in inner cities or like in other countries. And what I just thought who was a, you know, like...
A singer.
A singer, an entertainer who was just like literally glamorizing the hip-hop world. Then I started seeing the good side and I saw his hustle, right? And diverse. Like, you know, he's got shoes, he's got music, he's got nonprofits, he's working with Adidas, you know, and he's got so much going on, yet he still maintains this one persona.
Yeah.
You know? And I associate myself like that.
Awesome.
Like some people, like some of my friends, they tell me, it's like, how do you, like, you have so many projects, how do you have time? And I was like, I don't know. You know, it's like, I don't know how I have time, but they know me as Jabber.
Yeah.
There's no business Jabber. There's no, like, you know, friend Jabber. There's no whatever.
It's all Jabber.
It's one package, right?
Yeah. Dang.
Yeah. So when I look at Pharrell and I learned more about like what he did and all that, and I was like, okay, like I aspire to be like that.
Did someone ask you this before? Because never. That answer came out like just...
No. You know what? You asked me and I was trying to find somebody in the food world and I was like, no.
No.
It's not.
It's bigger than food.
Oh, yeah, it is. It definitely is.
Okay. Oh, man. That really threw me off guard. best tool you've purchased ever? And again, for context, usually I would say cooking tool here.
Yeah.
But given your work, I'm not going to put any label on it.
Best tool I've ever bought. It's a tough one. I have to go pretty generic here. It's my Mac. Yeah. I mean, it allows me to do everything.
Cool.
So, yeah. Cool.
Now, this one is actually a food question. Three ingredients to describe you.
Oh. Jalapeno.
Jalapeno, okay.
Damn, this is tough. What else? Jalapeno. Damn, you got me hard here. Jalapeno, watermelon, and dates.
Did you just throw that in there? Because you wanted to put something out of me in there? Because, you know, when you said jalapeno, I was like, all right, watermelon. I was like, dude, if he just adds tequila, that's a margarita. That's somebody who said dates. I'm like,
I can't say that. My mom will shun me.
We got to have like the halal and haram version of the podcast. All right, bro. All right. I see you. Okay. If you had to recommend one resource, which means either a book, documentary, song, whatever, that you're like, every person has to ingest this resource.
The Alchemist.
It's my favorite book of all time.
It's so simple and it has such, oh my God, like just a burst of spirituality. That like, it's like you're reading this entire story and then you realize the end is like, it's just a journey, right? Yeah. It's a journey that you get lost in.
When did you first read it? Do you remember?
College.
College.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried rereading it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. I don't know if this happened to you, because this is literally the book that I've recommended the most. Mm-hmm. Did you ever find it where when you're reading the story, every time you reread it, depending on where you were in life, it was a different story or different parts popped out?
You applied yourself to those situations.
Yeah.
For me, it's what I loved about it. Like, I've never read a book where I just got literally immersed into it. Mm. Like, I was there.
Yeah.
You know? And that's just the power of literature and communicating.
Yeah.
And, you know, just like being able to feel like you're there and walking through it, and then the ending just literally going through your body. Just like that. You're like, that's such a beautiful story. You didn't expect that ending.
No, yeah.
And, you know, it's just like it literally reinforces yourself as a human being. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I personally believe that we as a collective are stuck in this this routine. Right? A routine that's commonly accepted by everybody, and we end up losing out on our youth and the opportunity here.
The stuff that we already have.
Yeah, you know?
Not to give away the story, but everyone should read this book.
Oh yeah, please, please. And literally, it's cheap and it's quick to read. Like, you could read it in a night if you wanted to. But yeah, I think it puts things into perspective, and a relative perspective. Because, mm-hmm. like you said, like as you read it, you apply different things with respect to your life, where you're
at. Right. Damn, I'm so glad you said that, man. I just made my day. If you had to package the life of Jabir into one line, a one-line message, right, that you were going to put on all the Comida shirts or whatever future endeavor you have, one line to tell the world, what would that line read?
Good food, good people.
Damn.
Simple.
Hey, the simplest ones are the best.
Yep.
Okay. Last question is purely logistical. Where can people follow the story? Instagrams, Facebooks, list them out.
Yeah. You got Facebook, /Comida.
Okay.
You got Instagram, @EatComida, KOMEEDA. On Twitter, Comida, KOMEEDA. You can sign up on Comida and get into the... check out the experiences, but we'll also have a newsletter where we share our progress, upcoming experiences, chef stories, cool things like that. But yeah, if you just type in Comida, you'll find us. Wherever you follow us, we have a relatively fair presence.
Yeah, and you guys are, from what you told me, traveling nationwide, right?
Yeah, so the Displaced Kitchens has yielded a lot of responses. We've gotten emails from people who want to host Displaced Kitchens in their local cities. We have Richmond, Virginia. We have D.C., Pittsburgh, Salem, Massachusetts, Dallas, and a few other ones. So we're going to be hosting a nationwide campaign just to get people to hear more refugee stories, because they're not only here in New York. They're all over the country. Mm-hmm. So we have that going on. We're also working on a cookbook, Displaced Kitchens cookbook. That cookbook will also be used to share the stories of the refugees who we work with, kind of go a little more in depth with regards to how conflict creates an impact with cuisine, but also financially supporting the refugees who contribute to our book. This is in the works. We'll be putting together a Indiegogo campaign. Mm-hmm. Just to start fundraising and selling these books. But then also we will have a digital version where you could pay for individual recipes And every time you purchase a recipe, the refugee will be directly paid out. So just to awesome. Kind of help out with their financial awesome. Situation.
So if you're in any of those cities that Jabber mentioned, do check it out. If you are interested, I'll also put the contact information so you can get in touch with the team if they happen to be in your area. There was one, this is my mistake, there was one question that I don't know why I put this all the way at the end. I should have put it a little earlier. Oops. But I will close out with this question. If you could ask people to do one small thing, so when I say people, imagine the regular 9-to-5, really busy, probably wants to help out, but doesn't, I literally wrote this, like yeah. wants to do something, but they don't know what to do. If they could do something tomorrow, what should they do?
This may sound cliche, but literally follow your soul. It will, if you have something that's itching you and you're always thinking about it and you're just not, you don't feel very fulfilled with where you're at in life, go on that journey, right? Just start exploring. Find out what it is that's telling you to shift, right? I had no experience doing food.
Yeah.
Zero. And like 2.5 years later, it manifests into this pretty cool community that we built, close to 30,000 people in New York.
Shit.
Right? I've had no marketing experience, no restaurant experience, no business experience. And thank God and thank everything that has come my way. Like, we've developed something special with Comida. So if you pursue what you love, the universe will manifest for you.
And with that, we will close this episode. Thank you, sir, for being on our 21st episode.
Oh, thank you very much.
Super honored.
That was awesome.